pituitary warnings. Hello everyone, this is Jorge Facinetti. Today's podcast is about acromegaly cases that for a variety of reasons are difficult to determine. Here's Dr. Blevins.
This is Dr. Louis Blevins podcasting to you from Sausalito, California. It's a lovely evening. The sky is filled with an amazing bluish silver light with different orange and green hues, and it's absolutely lovely. I hope that you're treated to a similar lovely view from your window, from wherever you happen to be at whatever time of day you happen to be listening to this podcast. What I'd like to talk to you about today is acromegaly that is oftentimes difficult to discern because of either clinical or biochemical and radiographic features. I'll start with a case presentation. This is a patient I saw about 15 years ago. He was a surgeon who noted that his glove size requirement to operate had increased in size. And he sought medical attention to evaluate that. Was found to have classic physical features of acromegaly with a markedly elevated IGF-1. His pituitary MRI was normal. We evaluated him further for a neuroendocrine tumor producing growth hormone releasing hormone by checking his GHRH level, but that was also normal. I think he had an octreotide scan to look for a tumor elsewhere, and that was negative. And he elected to have a period of follow-up for about 6 months before he finally said, you know, I just want a pituitary exploration to see if there's a tumor. So we scheduled him for surgery, and the eve prior to surgery, he had an MRI at my request just to take another look, and sure enough, we saw a tumor in the anterior pituitary that measured about 3.5 to 4 millimeters. He went to surgery. The tumor was found. It was resected, and he was rendered disease-free as a consequence of surgery. Now, I don't know whether his tumor increased during that period of observation or whether the prior MRIs, which were good studies, were simply not sufficient to see his tumor at the time. Perhaps it was a contrast timing administration problem. Who knows? At any rate, he was successfully treated. He reminds me of patients that were reported in a study by Lonser and other in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism in 2010. And for those of you who want to chase down the paper, it's volume 95, page 4192 to 4196. In this study, they reported on 6 patients who had definite acromegaly, who had negative MRI studies, and they did a special volumetric breath-holding MRI and found a tumor in one patient. They took everybody to surgery and found tumors in every single patient, tumors ranging between 5 and 6.7 millimeters. And this points to the fact that some tumors are microadenomas and they're not seen on MRI. And the proper approach is to do, I think in this day and age, a dynamic contrast enhanced MRI or a pituitary exploration, as we had planned in my patient, to try to see these tumors that are very small. Keep in mind that about 10 to 30% of patients with acromegaly have small pituitary tumors. Most of the time they're visible on MRI, but obviously not always. The remaining patients usually have macroadenomas or pituitary hyperplasia, such as in McCune-Albright syndrome or with a growth hormone releasing hormone secreting tumor that we'll talk about a bit later. These patients often remind me of some of those described by Dr. Ariel Barkan that he referred to as micromegaly, who had normal growth hormone levels, elevated IGF-1 levels, classic biochemical features of acromegaly, and also had small tumors. Many of them early in his first series had tumors that were 2 to 3 millimeters in size and not seen on MRI. He reported a series in the year 2000 in the journal Pituitary. I think it was volume 19, page 547 or so. At least that's the note I have here in my handout here. At any rate, 157 patients, and what they found was the 24-hour mean growth hormone levels were normal in about 31% of people with elevated IGF-1 levels. Those who had, quote, normal, unquote, growth hormone secretion had smaller pituitary adenomas, with the average tumor size being 1.2 centimeter versus 1.8 centimeter for those with elevated growth hormone levels. What they also found was that giving the oral glucose suppression test, 50% of patients had a growth hormone level less than 1 and 30% were less than 0.4. Those are the two cutoffs that we use for the oral glucose suppression test. The first one for most growth hormone assays, the second one for most research and very highly sensitive growth hormone assays. The point being that a number of patients have small tumors, elevated IGF-1 levels, normal growth hormone levels, and actually suppressed with oral glucose. This is one of the reasons that in my practice, I tend to prefer to look at the clinical situation and the IGF-1 level. And if the IGF-1's elevated, but the growth hormone level is normal, sometimes I do an oral glucose suppression test, but I rarely do it for diagnosis these days. These types of situations remind me that a number of patients who have acromegaly do have small tumors, and their growth hormone secretion is not going to be excessive according to population standards, but it's probably excessive for that particular individual. And that comes into play when we're looking at IGF-1 levels as well. When you see an IGF-1 level, you see the upper to the lower, or the lower to the upper limit of normal, referencing the reference range for that stated test. And it's different from lab to lab, Quest to LabCorp to all sorts of other different groups that might perform the assay. But the thing to keep in mind is that most of the time, that's telling you the mean and the plus or minus 1.96 standard deviations, and roughly is including the middle 95% of the normal population. And by definition, 2.5% of people are going to have an elevated IGF-1 level but be entirely normal. And we actually see this group of patients too. Patients get an IGF-1 for whatever reason. Interestingly, in California, physicians often screening for growth hormone deficiency and not excess. They find the elevated IGF-1 and they send the patient for evaluation. These patients usually have normal growth hormone levels. Many of them suppress growth hormone normally with oral glucose. Their MRI studies are usually negative and they don't have acromegaly. Some of them we follow over time. Others we tell them to not worry about it and to forget about it. But usually I recommend follow-up for most patients. There was a study published in about 2017, Archives of Endocrinology and Metabolism, volume 61, starts on page 426. And in this particular study, they followed a number of patients. I don't remember how many it was, but it was a significant number. And it was basically patients who had elevated IGF-1 levels but suppressed growth hormone on oral glucose. And they had, maybe they had minimal symptoms or signs such that they might have had sleep apnea or arthritis or something like that. In their study, the range of IGF-1 levels was 1.08 to 1.53 times the upper limit of normal. For the assay where it was done. I think most of the people were women in this particular study. Negative MRIs, followed them for 5 years, and basically over that period, no one developed acromegaly. A number of people ultimately normalized their IGF-1 levels. One of the things they had thought about in this particular study was the fact that these may be people who simply have elevated IGF-1 levels but are part of the normal population that I had discussed earlier. I think what it points out to is that to have the diagnosis of acromegaly, you really need clinical and biochemical features. It's not simply just based on a blood test alone or clinical features alone. With that said, another population where acromegaly diagnosis can be sort of curious is that we see patients periodically who have clinical features of acromegaly, no doubt about it. You can spot them as they walk in the doorway. But their IGF-1 levels are normal. Maybe they're even low and they have growth hormone deficiency. And when you do an MRI of the pituitary, you see that they have a very enlarged cella, and sometimes they have an empty cella, and they occasionally have one or more pituitary hormone deficits. These are people who probably had acromegaly due to a large pituitary tumor at some time in the past and the tumor infarcted or underwent apoplexy, died, their IGF-1 levels fell to normal and sometimes low, their pituitary hormone deficits persist, and their clinical features probably improve somewhat, but to those of us who are trained observers, they still have clinical features of acromegaly. They don't need any special treatment because there's nothing we can do to reverse those clinical features that we see, and oftentimes we treat them with growth hormone if they have growth hormone deficiency. Another subset of patients that's rather difficult to diagnose sometimes are those who have acromegaly, elevated IGF-1 levels, but no pituitary adenoma, and have a neuroendocrine tumor somewhere based on the fact that their growth hormone releasing hormone levels are elevated. Fortunately, most of the time, these patients have tumors that are identifiable. Unfortunately, many of them have pancreatic tumors that are rather large, but there are other tumors that can produce growth hormone releasing hormone as well. One subtype, usually seen in kids with giantism, is a hamartoma of the hypothalamus producing growth hormone. And sometimes these patients also have tumors that secrete gonadotropins, leading to precocious puberty as well as acromegaly. And then we're faced with occasional patients who present with a non-functioning tumor, no evidence of acromegaly whatsoever on exam, and they have normal IGF-1 levels or maybe slightly low IGF-1 levels, but the growth hormone level may be normal or elevated in the course of doing the random workup. Again, they're thought to have a non-functioning tumor. They go to surgery, and the pathologist tells us that the tumor has immunostained for growth hormone in high amounts and maybe even a somatostatin type 2 receptor, indicating that it's truly a growth hormone secreting pituitary adenoma. These patients are not uncommon. We maybe see 2 to 3 of them a year at UCSF. These we refer to as silent growth hormone secreting pituitary adenomas. What's going on here is the tumor has the ability to produce growth hormone, but not the ability to secrete an active or a functional molecule into the bloodstream. And if it does secrete the molecule into the bloodstream, the growth hormone is often biologically inactive. So they might see the growth hormone, but the IGF-1 level will stay normal. These patients we treat as non-functioning tumors. Somatostatin analogs usually don't work to control the disease process. We just follow them along over time. I've not seen one revert to functional or a functional tumor, as can be seen in some of the silent ACTH-producing tumors where they can ultimately revert to Cushing syndrome with functional tumor when they recur. I've not yet seen that with acromegaly, but I watch patients just to see if that's going to be the case in the future. So what I've tried to cover this evening is a spectrum of patients with acromegaly who have the disease process and have small tumors or have sort of twist to the disease process where you don't see a tumor on the MRI. But I've also mentioned the patients who maybe fit into that normal population of those who have a high IGF-1 level but don't have disease and never are demonstrated to have the disease over time. And I wanted to talk about these cases because those of you who have these situations are out there. And I think the take-home message is that if you have definite acromegaly with biochemical features of acromegaly but a negative MRI, just have your doctor pursue it. Get a dynamic contrast enhanced MRI or go to a tertiary medical center where they focus on pituitary disease and have an evaluation and maybe even exploration by a very experienced pituitary neurosurgeon who can address this issue more carefully for you. And then the other side of the coin is that if you have an elevated IGF-1 but no obvious clinical features of acromegaly normal glucose suppression, you're probably okay, and you can get followed up over time if you'd like. But just relax and be grateful that you don't have this horrible disfiguring disease. Remember, in this day and age, we don't simply want to diagnose and treat disease based on biochemical tests. We have to have a clinical syndrome as well. And if you think you have acromegaly but don't prove to have it biochemically, certainly there wouldn't be any indication for treatment at that time, and follow-up would be useful. Remember that our treatment decision-making is based on several research studies showing normalization of IGF-1 normalizes survival. So those who have normal IGF-1 levels whether or not they feel like they have acromegaly. We simply don't have anything to offer in that particular situation. Those who have the elevated IGF-1 levels but no acromegaly, you're probably just normal for your body. And I've seen plenty of patients like that over the years, even patients with non-functioning tumors and elevated IGF-1 levels, and they don't prove to have acromegaly and no staining of their tumor for growth hormone. But those of you with the real disease, you need to track it down and figure out why you have it and get appropriate treatment by experienced healthcare providers. Well, that's all I had for this evening. Thank you for your time and attention. As usual, send us your comments, questions, because you prompt us to consider podcasts that may be useful to our pituitary community as a whole. Once again, this has been Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, and I'm wishing you all a very good evening, morning, or whatever the situation may be in your home at the time you conclude this podcast. Take care.
Please send your comments and questions to pituitarywellnews.org. And don't forget to subscribe to our articles and podcasts. Thank you for listening.